Hey, it's Brian. Coming up on today's podcast, James Kimball, VP of Operations for the UFC Performance Institute. But first, a little question for you. Are you a new graduate or working professional interested in a university-level sports management education without the cost or commitment of a traditional master's program? This kind of fits me, to be honest. Always thought about a master's, but I mean, just never had the time. Well, here's another option. The University of California, Irvine now offers an online open enrollment 4-course sport management certificate that prepares you for a career in the business of sports. Learn more about this exciting opportunity and download a sports management career planning toolkit at ce.uci.edu/sport management. One more time, ce.uci.edu/sport management. Now, let's start the countdown.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Clapp, VP of Content and Engaged Learning at WorkInSports.com, and this is the Work in Sports Podcast. Every time I see a list, it's an annual list from Forbes or some other magazine, touting the most valuable sports franchises in the world, I'm kind of blown away. Dallas Cowboys worth $5 billion, Real Madrid worth $4.2 billion. Even the damn New York Knicks, who haven't won a game in like 5 years and have a nutbag owner, are worth $4 billion. Of course, that's hyperbole. The Knicks have won a few games. So often when these numbers are posted, fans revolt in a way. You see snide comments all over the place about greedy, money-grubbing owners, high ticket prices. You hear labor complaints about guaranteed contracts and health issues of former athletes. The organizations and leagues are painted as cold, manipulative monsters, only out for the bottom line, dragging their athletes along, using them like cattle, and then getting rid of them when they provide less value. But that's never the whole story. It's kind of the easy story to tell, to be honest. Dig a little deeper, and you find that the soul of these organizations is a little more subtle than some revenue sheet. There are efforts that aren't in the public eye, organized by teams and leagues to help and support and work with their athletes as a partnership. Take the UFC, for example. President Dana White recently stated that UFC was worth $7 billion. That's a jaw-dropping number. And you wonder, how much of that goes to the athletes in one form or another? How much is done to support them? Well, the short answer is a lot. They have support programs for their retired fighters, athlete development programs to assist the fighters outside the octagon, and recently unveiled the UFC Performance Institute, a $14 million, 30,000 square foot facility that serves as the world's first MMA Multidisciplinary Research, Innovation, and Performance Center. This center, with its altitude chambers, nap pods, nutrition center, therapy rooms, underwater treadmills, and more, is 100% free to athletes on the UFC roster. Free. Completely focused on helping the athletes cut weight the right way, build a solid plan for their fight needs, and for their recovery, mentally and physically. The man running this facility and who played a major role in its overall design and development is James Kimball, VP of Operations for the UFC Performance Institute, and he's today's guest. Hey, James, how's it going today?
I'm doing well, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm excited to talk to you about all that's going on in your career at UFC. You're in Vegas, so it's a hot time in the summer, so I'm happy that...
It is.
Yeah, I'm thinking you're dealing with some major heat right now.
Yeah, it was, I think, 113 last week was the high I got you. So they say it's a dry heat, though.
Yeah.
But it is still very hot, I'll tell you.
That's insanity. So, like, when you walk into work, does, like, the pavement kind of stick to your shoes? Like, does it kind of feel like it's melting underneath you?
I'll tell you this. About a year ago, we actually just installed a car park roof shade. So before that, though, everyone was dying. It gets really hot here in the dog days of summer, that's for sure.
Yeah, and then you enter the office and it's like 68 degrees, perfect temperature.
Yeah.
Can't beat that.
Right.
So
straight into the cold plunge.
Yeah, exactly. So let's dig into this. I'm really excited to talk to you about your career and your time at UFC in particular, but Everybody that I speak with, they all have this moment. They have a time where they went from being, you know, a high school athlete or playing sports or watching sports, where they all of a sudden had this moment where they're like, you know what? This is what I want to do. This is my career. This is what I want to push forward into. Did you have a moment like that? And if so, what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of just alluded to it for me. I guess it's pretty common, but yeah, I mean, I was probably your typical high school athlete, you know, played football and baseball, and despite being 5'8", 170 pounds, figured I'd be playing pros at some point, and just, you know, always just assumed that. And I actually played, so I mean, if I had to point to one moment, it is this. So I played 1 year of D2 football. So even going through high school in my senior year, I was, you know, I was working to get scholarships from D2 schools, never really focusing on kind of what I wanted to do in terms of an actual career. I played 1 year of D2 ball, and again, just kind of went through that and understood, okay, this is not going to be something that I do for the long term. And towards the end of that first year, I actually started thinking around transferring schools and actually starting, you know, like a proper approach, and you know, dedicate myself to education and and really start to grow into a career. And then I transferred into George Mason University and majored in sport administration. And it was kind of from that moment. So I guess it was, you know, my high school career, you know, kind of single-minded approach led into 1 year of playing college ball. And then I said, look, hey, this ain't working out. I need to take a different approach. But it was always still sports for me. It was always still sports. So I found a good program in Mason. And then, I guess that's kind of where it started.
So your first job out of college, you're sports administration major, you're at a good program at George Mason. Your first job out of college, you're with the Washington Wizards and you're in sales. Mm-hmm. So we tell this, I tell this to people all the time. I have never worked in sales. I've never been on that side of the industry, but of our job board, we have 14,000 jobs right now. About 7,000 of them are in sales because that's the way the industry works. But some people love it. Some people hate it. Where did you kind of fit in the sales spectrum? How is that match for you?
Yeah, I mean, I was in the middle. You know, I did it for 1 year, so that could probably tell you all you need to know.
Right.
But I share this with other people too who are trying, you know, just coming up. Is you're trying to break in, you know, you're likely going to end up in sales, and for most people, you're probably not going to love it. I mean, it is just naturally a challenging thing to do for a 21 or 22 year old just to, you know, sit in a cube all day and just cold call 60, 80, 100 strangers and pitch them on season tickets. I mean, it's not natural. But I think what's important there is you have to keep focused on the big picture and perspective and understand that, hey, this is how you crack into the industry. And at some point, whether it's with that organization or another, you're going to find some footing. But look, I appreciated the hustle of it. I mean, it was good fun. My 1 year with the Wizards was actually one of the playoff years when Gil Arenas was doing great work. So it was a fun season. And like I said, I appreciated it. I mean, the offices were in the Verizon Center. So it was a good experience. But, you know, for me, I wanted more. I definitely wanted more. So I just kept on, you know, kind of moving through the industry from there.
Yeah, that's interesting. You did jump around a bit after that. You were in tennis for a little while.
Yep.
You were in college recruiting for baseball, SB Nation on the content side.
Yeah.
Was this just part of your kind of journey to discovery of figuring out what like made you happy or where you fit or what was, or were you feeling kind of like lost and confused and just trying different things out? What was kind of happening for you at that time as you were kind of jumping through the early points of your career?
Yeah, so when I was working in tennis at a now kind of former sports agency called Best Blue Entertainment Sports and Television, that was the tennis bit, and honestly, that was as close as I could get to the agent side. And I mean, gosh, how cliche is this? But I was definitely that kid who kind of just grew up in the Jerry Maguire era and figured that, you know, well, this is what it means to work in sports as an agent. So I did that for a while. I actually worked under Andy Roddick's agent and the agent for the Bryan brothers, and had some fun there. I mean, tennis is, you know, it's always been a sport that I've found really interesting and, you know, appreciated. So I did that for a little bit, and yeah, worked in baseball recruiting side, and then on the SB Nation side was actually while I was going back into grad school. So I let's see, I graduated from Mason, and then for maybe about 2 years probably, I worked for the Wizards and this agency that I mentioned. And then I actually went back into school to get a master's of sport administration from Georgetown University, which is when I started to work with SB Nation just on the side as like an unpaid internship.
Right.
Actually, what I was doing for them for the most part was some content work on the MMA side. So the sport of mixed martial arts was really like the fandom really was founded on the internet. So SB Nation managed a few of the biggest blogs in the MMA space. There was a blog there. They still exist today. Bloody Elbow.
Right. I've seen that.
One. MMA Mania is one. That's actually one that I used to write for. So I was just doing that going through grad school. But you know, again, it was just good exposure to the other side of, very different side of the industry. Again, I mean, gosh, look at the content side now and the digital space now. You know, 10 years ago, it was pretty different. But that's how I kind of first got connected to the MMA space.
Did that experience with SB Nation and doing the MMA coverage and some of the content in that world, did that help you build a network in MMA? Did that lead to some connections with UFC that eventually led to your first job with her?
So this is a true story.
Ooh, good. So I like stories. Go ahead.
Yeah. After my graduation from Georgetown, I spent, you know, a few weeks like anyone else towards the end of the program, just shooting off, you know, applications and resumes to all the local local teams and organizations. I figured I'd pick right back up, get a job with the Nationals or Redskins or whatnot, and I took maybe 2 minutes. And fired off a resume to a posting online around a kind of a fan engagement role for UFC. Just a massive fan at the time, never thinking anything would come of it.
Right.
And, you know, a week later, I get an email in my inbox, you know, saying that I've made it to, you know, this stage in the interview process. And a week later, I'm doing, you know, a Skype interview. And then just a week after that, I'm in Vegas doing in-person interview with the chief operating officer. And then literally the following week. So this is all within a month. I'm looking at apartments in Vegas.
That's awesome.
And the true story that I was referencing was, so my hiring manager, I don't know how we brought this up. We were discussing it, you know, on one of my first days was kind of like, hey, you know, I think she mentioned that there was maybe 900 applicants at that point. And like what stuck out. And I was kind of assuming that a master's degree from Georgetown University was one of the main ones that helped.
Right. You hope
so,
right?
She actually said, yeah, right. And she actually said, well, the biggest thing was your work on the MMA blog that you were doing, because what they wanted to do on the fan engagement side was build out a blog on their website. Our fan club at the time was called UFC Fight Club, and part of what they wanted to do to grow that business was to grow this blog. And she saw that I had that like exact experience of posting around just like MMA content, and that was it. So it was, again, it was something that was just kind of peripheral, you know, throughout my, you know, grad program, and ended up being the one thing that got me in the door. So it's pretty interesting how that worked out.
See, I love that because it's a direct connection to the skills you developed and the things you were doing, the activities you were doing. Like, your activities led to the opportunity, and I love that. I've shared this story a lot on the podcast before, but I started out in college as like a biology and chemistry double major. Like, it made no sense whatsoever. I didn't know. I was totally lost. And then, you know, I eventually switched to the TV production journalism side of things and had a slant towards sports. And literally my senior year, I started working for the campus TV station, and I learned a certain skill, nonlinear editing. And I learned that skill. And then CNN, Sports Illustrated were starting a new sports network, and they needed people that had that exact skill. So it wasn't anything else. It was nothing else I had done in my entire college career. It was that one skill that made the difference. And that sounds like exactly what happened to you.
That's it. And you never know. And while you're going through that, you never know how that's going to benefit you moving forward.
Yeah.
It's funny. I mean, honestly, I still kind of laugh about that experience, and that, you know, posting as a fan, just like at midnight, you know, on watching fights, like posting fight videos and commenting on a fight, that got me to work for UFC.
That's
when you
awesome.
Really boil boil it all down. So it's funny how that works out.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, okay, let's talk about that fan experience job. I imagine working in UFC, you've had all these different experiences, you know, tennis and NBA and some of the different experiences that you've had. I imagine you working in UFC is a little different than your other stops. How different was that environment? And did you feel like once you got there, you were just hooked right away? Like you were really into this whole scene and the opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a different environment. The second I walked through the lobby the first time, I mean, it was just like mystified ground almost, to be honest. And it's funny because, we were in our old headquarters. You know, we'll get to our new headquarters in a little bit. But we were, UFC's headquarters were just like across the street from this local casino in town. And there was like an In-N-Out Burger directly in front of the campus. And you didn't really know. It's just a bunch of nondescript office buildings. But the second you walk into the lobby, you know, there's big event photos of, you know, like Chuck Liddell and, you know, DJ Penn and all those guys. Yeah. But no, I mean, there was an energy. There was an energy to this campus, you know, a decade ago. You know, right now, UFC maybe has about 300 global employees, about, you know, 250, 270 that work here in Vegas. At that time, maybe there was 100.
Okay.
It was like mom and pop shop almost, you know, because it was still, and it still was, you know, it was being, you know, the Fertitta brothers were the owner, and of course with, you know, Dana White then and still, you know, president. It was a company that every day, and this is not hyperbole, every day you come into work, you don't know what's going to hit, because the growth and the pace and how we were scaling was so unbelievable. I mean, I started in 2010, and in 2011 was when the UFC partnered with Fox for our first kind of big broadcast deal, and that changed the sport.
Yeah.
You know, when we look back on the sport of UFC and how it's grown, you know, 20, 50 years from now, that'll be a seminal moment. It still is. It's something that we all talk to, but you go from the days of, you know, being banned on pay-per-view, et cetera, then you're on Spike TV, but then you're on Fox, right? Like you're right after like a Yankees Red Sox game, you know, it's like, that's when you've made it. So that happened just a year and to me working with the company, but just, you know, it's just it's a level of passion, commitment, and just innovation. You know, there's just an entrepreneurial feel to what we were doing then and still are. But at that moment though, it was really unique and special to be a part of.
Yeah. It's almost like you're a tech startup where you're like, you're trying something completely new. I mean, this is really, yes, there's been other professional sports leagues, obviously, but this is a very unique approach. It's not like boxing. It's not like anything else out there, and you have to sell it and do everything in a very different fashion. So it had to be just a really exciting culture to be a part of.
Yeah. And I mean, look, I mean, anyone that follows the UFC or even, you know, knows about it, a little bit is probably where Dana White, our president, and I mean, he is as passionate of a leader as there could be that I've ever been around. That's for sure. And, you know, one of the great things at UFC is that, you know, we are very ambitious, and Dana does not take no from anyone in any sense of the word. So we are always pushing new boundaries, and it's something that we live by. One of our 8 brand maxims is to be first. So we obviously within the combat sport, you know, community perceive ourselves as to be leaders in the sport, but just in global sport performance and, you know, global sport, you know, business and operations. I mean, we're live 42 events out of the year now. We had an event this weekend in Uruguay. We have an event next weekend in Anaheim. Then we're in Shenzhen, China. The next weekend we're in Abu Dhabi. Tell me another sporting organization that has that type of schedule globally.
That's crazy.
And it's just around the hustle and innovation and the passion to scale this, and really the fan base that has grown with the company. But, you know, it is a really unique operation here. That's for sure. It's exciting to be a part of.
It must be so. You can hear it in your voice as you describe it too. Like just thinking of having a leadership team like Dana, led by Dana, who has, like you said, that has an attitude of like, it doesn't take no for an answer. Like this is you have a very powerful person at the top. I would think that is an inspiring situation to live in, where you know, like you're going to have the opportunity to do things and to create things and to try to achieve at this high level, and know that you're going to have a strong leadership ahead of you leading the way.
And it's almost like, look, you share that sense of responsibility. It's like, well, look, I mean, Dana's out there sharing this vision and passion and hustling and making things work, you better bring that to what you're doing every day.
Right.
Or else, you know what? The UFC's not for you. You know, and I'm in my ninth year now at UFC, and a lot of people have come, a lot of people gone, a lot of people still here from you know, when I was here. Not that many. But, you know, just because, again, it's the nature of the business and sports generally. But it is a something to where you step into this campus that if you don't have the hustle to create and innovate and build, like if you come in here and you're content and you're working 9 to 5, and you're just, like I said, you're content in the space in which you're operating, this is not the environment for you. And I think most people appreciate the ability to create and go to their executive team and say, hey, what about this and that? And then to have the executive team say, yeah, actually, that's great. Go, fire away, green light. So we actually live by that here, though, which is really unique.
No, that's powerful. So you're a VP now, but back when you first started, you're an entry-level fan engagement coordinator. Mm. Tell me about that specific experience. What was that like? I mean, obviously, you've had to move cross-country. You're going to a place you haven't lived before. You're in this totally new environment, this cutting-edge sport, and now you're on the job. Like, what was that first experience like, and what was that role kind of like for you?
Yeah, so that role was fan experience coordinator. That was around kind of what I mentioned around building out this fan club, but it was also around activating events, fan events at UFC events. So there was a bit of travel, which was nice, especially, you know, as a young kid. Even though when I moved out to Vegas, I left my now wife, and we were apart for about a year.
Okay.
So we were, you know, I was managing a long distance relationship at that time too, but. You know, I would travel to events, and the great thing about that role was I used to go to the events that I was now coordinating. So the UFC back in the day, you know, when we had an event, let's say in New Jersey, in Newark, New Jersey, they would put on these fan events, UFC Fight Club parties, where UFC fighters would go to like a local, you know, bar or restaurant.
Yeah.
You can have, you know, food and drinks, and you can meet the fighters and hang out with the fighters and sign fighters, which, you know, to get autographs from fighters, which is really cool in this sport, is that, you know, it's something we've always touted ourselves on, but we provide unparalleled access to our fighters for our fans. And that's always been the case. So I used to travel the Eastern Seaboard going to these, and now I'm on the other side, like coordinating them and building them out.
Yeah.
So I was doing that for a couple of years, and I loved it because it was me. Like I'm building out events, servicing events for people that literally were me. So I loved that hustle. And then from there, I mean, actually from there, interestingly enough, the departments that I work for, so I did some community relations work and then athlete development into now what, you know, what the PI is. Those departments did not exist. So they were actually departments that were founded and created kind of along my journey and pathway. And I like to think, you know, I help to lead that charge. But at that time, again, UFC, when I first started, maybe 100 employees, you know, we've not, you know, built out the internal departments and verticals that we have now. But I mean, community relations was something that UFC started to embark in. So how do we take this kind of fan experience engagement service that we're providing, but how do we support local communities? And when we visit LA or Chicago or New York, how do we tap into the local combat community and charitable community, et cetera, et cetera. So I started to do a lot of that work. Which along the whole time I was working with athletes on the other side. So whether it's, you know, fan experience or community relations, they all require athlete engagement at some capacity. So I was always working with athletes. And then we built out, athlete development, which was really interesting and really where I kind of found my home, was a department that, again, was born out of myself and a couple other people who were managing what the athletes were doing outside of competing. So you name it. If they weren't, you know, fighting in the octagon, I was kind of across their schedule. So if it was, you know, promotional appearances, you know, corporate partner appearances, any type of charitable work, community relations work, et cetera. And also I would interface a lot with their agents and then really with the athletes directly. Because to be honest, especially, you know, a few years ago, maybe half the UFC roster didn't even have agent representation, right?
Oh, really?
I mean, you were self-managed, or you were managed by, you know, your brother, That's how it was. So we did a lot of that. And then that department started to grow into, okay, what type of resources can we provide UFC athletes? Let's start to professionalize this. So we started to build out summits and symposiums, just like, you know, people are aware of, like NFL rookie symposiums or anything like that. UFC was doing that a few years ago, to where we would host new athlete summits. So athletes that are, you know, kind of young into the sport, we don't have rookies, you know, per se, but
right.
same intents and purposes. That would basically onboard them to the company organization and, you know, expose them to the type of resources they have available now with, you know, the UFC machine behind them. We would have veteran summits, and those were some of my favorites. Those were to support athletes who were kind of transitioning out of the sport.
Yeah.
You know, this is an individual sport, and for the most part, you're probably not making a ton of money a few years ago, you know, unless you were a champion or a top contender. So you're having to do something else with your life. So we would focus on, you know, financial stability, entrepreneurship, you know, managing your own brand, managing your own finances, et cetera, media training, all those type of things. So we would provide those in-house, and we would fly athletes from all over the world into Vegas for a couple of days. And, you know, we would bring in content experts and, you know, put them up at the Red Rock here in Las Vegas off the strip. And, you know, those are really enjoyable times building those out. And then that started to grow into focusing on performance aspects. So starting to understand what type of access to performance-related services UFC athletes had. So I partnered with kind of a few third-party organizations and companies that would provide some remote support for our athletes. And then, you know, at that point, I was director of athlete development. And then that was, 2016, and that's when the idea of the UFC Performance Institute was founded, really.
So before we get into the Performance Institute, because I want to talk a lot about that, I want to really dig into something here, is that I hear you talking about the UFC, and I feel this as somebody who's worked in sports for his entire career, that most fans think of the organizations as being just capitalist, business hungry, money hungry, you know, sell more stuff, get more tickets sold. And yet what you're talking about and everything that you mentioned in there was about the soul of your organization. It was about the people. It was about the athletes. It was about making them the best they could be and caring about them as people. And I think that's something that doesn't always get highlighted enough in our sports world.
Yeah. And I tell you, you know, the UFC, again, if you live in the combat sports bubble, the UFC takes these type of shots pretty often in terms of, you know, how UFC athletes don't get paid enough, don't get supported. And that's a conversation for another day. But I can tell you that I've lived it for the last decade. The UFC absolutely values its number one asset, which is its athletes. And behind closed doors, I mean, we would never even really publicize this. I mean, maybe a couple times we'd have some local media attend to understand what's going on. But annually, oftentimes multiple times a year, we would host these summits. And look, we would spare no expense. We bring in some high profile speakers, really other you know, athletes from other sports that are really high profile, and just share their journey with them. But yeah, it's all around, look, providing resources for these athletes who, by the way, which is really unique and different, they're all independent contractors. They're not employees or of the organization.
Right.
But it's understanding that we're going to go as far as our athletes go, and how far our athletes take us. And we really wanted to, I think it comes down to, we wanted to professionalize this. You know, again, this is something that, you know, the UFC still deals with today. I think obviously very much less so now that we're a member of the Disney family on ESPN. But, you know, a decade ago, I mean, look, the bottom line is we're still a sport where people fight in a cage. So there's certain kind of misconceptions that come with that and perceptions. But ultimately, we want to professionalize this. And we wanted our athletes to feel like they're professional athletes, which they are. And, you know, we did a ton of, you know, investigative work, just understanding what other leagues and teams were doing and some of the best practices for how they support athletes. And again, going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, I mean, this is, these are departments and initiatives that we created, a couple of, you know, kind of mid management, you know, guys in their 20s went to the CEO, Lorenzo Fertitta, and was like, hey, what do you think about doing this moving forward?
Yeah.
And then, you know, we presented a plan and a proposal and, you know, fleshed it out. And again, like just as I was saying at the top, you got the green light and off you go. And then from there, you better deliver the best damn, you know, program than you can, because that's the expectation. So Lorenzo and Dana would come to these summits and you know, and it'd be a great time for the athletes to, you know, to meet and interact with the guys who run the company, which again, I think is probably pretty rare across other sports and especially other leagues. You know, they have FaceTime with the guys at the top, at all these, you know, various kind of company initiatives. So no, it's something that we value. And look, I mean, obviously with the Performance Institute, you know, if that doesn't tell you how much we value our athletes, then I don't know what would.
Yeah. So let's get into this, because I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of the UFC. I know the fighters. I watch the fights. I love it. But I'll admit that I'm lacking some knowledge. I want you to explain the UFC Performance Institute to me, because you see the championship level fighters as they're preparing for a fight, and you see them with their team, and you see them in their training facility. You see them out in like Big Bear or somewhere in California at high altitude training. And whatever. So you envision as a casual fan that they all have their own facilities they go to and their own teams they work with. And yet you guys have developed this incredible Performance Institute. What role does that play in their development? How does it all work?
Yeah. So again, probably around 2016, we were building out our new global headquarters, which the PI is now the anchor of. At that time, there was no plan for a PI. Also at that time, the company kept on running into these performance-related issues that would impact fight cards. So, you know, when a main event or a co-main event falls out from an event, you know, that can impact the company's bottom line depending on the size of the event by 3, 5, 7 million.
Yeah.
So you can imagine that happens quite often, and it started to become a real obstacle that, you know, the business had to find a way to kind of wrap our arms around, start to understand it, and start to influence. So again, going back to my point around independent contractor athletes, not employees, we have at this point just around 600 athletes on the global roster. 47 countries, different countries are represented on a global roster. You know, talk about global dispersion. This is such a decentralized sport. You know, you mention any, you know, kind of domestic NBA or NFL team, and you know, those players and athletes that everyone, you know, loves to see compete on the weekend. I mean, their performance teams, you know, have visibility into what those athletes are doing every single day. In this sport, we didn't. So the two biggest things was, one, to create visibility, start to understand really like what are UFC athletes doing as they prepared for and then recovered from competition. Because at that point, really, we'd only see UFC athletes for a couple days, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times a year, right, on fight weeks. And that's a very different, you know, experience for an athlete on a fight week, you know, setting up shop at the MGM Grand back in the day versus in their home training camp.
Right.
So one, visibility. Two, influence. So again, you know, this sport is still so young, and really, even to this point, there's, you know, not a ton of access to really elite, kind of world-class performance resources that other pro athletes have access to in their own kind of team facilities. So what we did was said, look, we have to create something tangible, something that can be a destination for these athletes, to where they have access to these type of resources. So it was at that point that myself and actually, Forrest Griffin, who works internally with us and is on the staff now, they said, hey, go figure this out. And this is, you know, this was one of those things where I didn't have a ton of experience in performance. Like, I've been an athlete my whole life, and, you know, I'm very aware of kind of what athletes go through in the training side, but in terms of building out a high performance facility, I have not done that before. So we worked with a consultant, a kind of a project manager who actually built out the Manchester City campus, you know, from Man City, the team in the EPL, which, I mean, their training academy is considered to be one of the world's best. So we spent a year just benchmarking across other high performance facilities, identifying best practices, obviously talked to our own community, of which Forrest has been a part of his whole life, and me for, you know, half a decade at that time. And what the PI is intended to be is a one-stop shop of services for UFC athletes across all performance-related impacting services. So what we provide is strength and conditioning support, nutrition, physical therapy, and sports science. Now, if you're a UFC athlete, you have a team around you. For the most part, that team is MMA focused. So you have a striking coach, you have a wrestling coach. Maybe you have a strength coach, and maybe the strength coach also is the personal trainer at the 24-hour fitness down the street.
Right.
That's not to say that's the case across the board, but there is a vacuum of, you know, of professionals in performance within MMA. When it comes to nutrition, that's another good example. For the most part, your nutrition is being kind of led by like your wife or your spouse in terms of like, you know, preparing meals for you. People really need to realize that the way these athletes, even though, you know, you see them on TV fighting, you know, fighting on ESPN, it's like their process for, you know, of getting to competition is very different than what NFL athletes and NBA athletes are used to. So that's what we wanted to create. We wanted to create a professional environment which really accelerated the evolution of the sport. And that's one of a line in our mission statement is to accelerate the evolution of mixed martial arts by identifying best practices and sharing that with our global community. So that's what we did. We opened in May 2017. We recruited a performance team that if you work within high performance, you appreciate the type of staff that we put together. We recruited them from all outside the sport of MMA. We have staff members that work for United States Olympic Committee, Great Britain Olympic Committee, major D1 universities, professional organizations, all that at some point in their career touched combat sports. So they kind of know and knew what a combat athlete was and the demands were. And then we brought them all to Vegas, and we've been growing the team ever since. And, you know, what our kind of focus is to identify the gap. So an athlete comes to us, you can be a champion, you can be your second fight within the organization, and we identify a gap. You come to us and say, look, I really need help with weight management. You know, I'm a 185 pounder, but, you know, I really struggle with the weight class. Then we'll provide all the support that we can. Our facility is in Vegas is 30,000 square foot. It has all the diagnostics and sports science and technology and all the capabilities that you can ever imagine. We have integrated force plates and, you know, we have an innovation lab and altitude chambers and cryotherapy chambers and, all the recovery modalities that you can ever want. So you come to us and basically you receive a objective understanding of what it means to be, you know, a UFC athlete. And then in your case, each individual athlete case, what exactly you're faced with and kind of what limitations that you have, what opportunities for growth that you have, and then we'll support you either in the facility if you're spending time with us for a month, or remotely anywhere around the world. You know, when we opened doors, there were about a dozen athletes who live in Las Vegas, and now there are over 30. So people are starting to move here and utilize it as kind of their home base. But for the most part, this is a place that helps to supplement their training. So we don't teach MMA strategy here. You know, we don't have MMA coaches. So again, that we don't want to get involved in the strategy bit of it. We don't want to, you know, take on that kind of that burden to where potentially we're supporting, you know, athletes around the strategy and the IP bit. That's not our bag. What we want to do is help get athletes to the competition, and keep them safe and keep them healthy. And, you know, avoid this kind of, you know, extreme weight cuts and, you know, improper rehabs, et cetera. So that was our mission. And that's what we aim to do.
It's amazing. I saw a video just recently as I was preparing for this conversation, and it had like Conor McGregor in an altitude chamber at the facility. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the craziest thing. Like, what does that feel like when the organizational strategy says, hey, I want you to build me the greatest fitness center ever created. Spare no expense. Go to it. Like, yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine what that must have been like for you.
It's pretty daunting, again, especially at that time when, you know, when we were building out Vegas. Again, that's basically what they said was to go figure it out. There wasn't even a budget reference at that point. We started to zero it in, especially when UFC was acquired by Now Endeavor, Ari Emanuel's company. So we started to zero that in. But yeah, it was really unique too, because, you know, if you think about it, like if you work for the New York Giants and you're building out a new training facility, it's unlikely that you get welcomed into the Redskins, Eagles, and Cowboys facility as benchmarks. But we have no competitors in that space. So myself and Forrest and then this our project manager, Nick, we went to over 60 facilities all around the world, and they all welcomed us with open arms, and all, fans of the UFC. And so we were able to see the, the latest and greatest. And, that's something that we pride ourselves on too. And like at the flip side of that was we didn't want to just open with all the bells and whistles and have none of it be functional and serve a purpose, because then this place is really seen as like really just like a showpiece, as like just a promotional piece. Like, hey, this is, the UFC is just, investing in this, trying to show that they're helping support athletes. So it's quite the opposite. We were very disciplined into the type of infrastructure that we built out here and what we invested in. And look, I mean, we're 2 years into this. On a monthly average, we support about 175 athletes on the roster, which is a third of the roster, all voluntarily, again, because they're independent contractors. We have just opened our second in Shanghai, China. So now we're moving into, the business of developing talent internally. So we've identified China as most organizations have and do, as an area for key international growth. And for us, the way we develop the business is to create local talent. Right now there's about 10 athletes on the roster from China. We want that number to be 4X, 5X, 6X, et cetera.
Yeah.
So now the PI is growing in that sense in terms of having the academy model within, but it's helped driving the business. And I just got back this weekend from Mexico City. And so we're going to open another facility in Mexico City and take the same marketing strategy into Mexico and Latin America next year. So now as you dive in and start to build these facilities, now we really have fun, because now we've been exposed to kind of the challenges and the obstacles that we have, really what works, what necessarily doesn't. But again, we are afforded some great resources here within the company. So we are able to build what we think is the world's best. I mean, just in Shanghai, the facility we just opened, it's 90,000 square foot. I've been the most. It is unbiased and objectively speaking, the best high performance training center in the world.
Wow.
It is one of a kind. And now that's a resource that these local, kids, 19, 20, 21 year old, kids all throughout mainland China have the ability to access at no cost. By the way, I must say this, at no cost in China, at no cost in Vegas. If you're on the roster, you can utilize all of our services, including eating for free in our cafe with meal plans that are built by our nutritionists, all the strength and conditioning programming, et cetera. As soon as you walk through our gates, everything is on the UFC's arm. So going back to like, hey, this is a real investment into the athletes and to the sport of mixed martial arts, just to evolve the game.
So you mentioned Forrest Griffin a couple of times, UFC Hall of Famer, right? He's the VP of athlete development with the PI. And so you guys work pretty closely together. How important is it to have somebody who has been inside the ring, is a professional athlete, goes through the training, knows what he needs? How important is it to have an asset like that, that you can bounce ideas off of and just kind of collaborate with to make it the best it possibly can be?
No, that's it. I mean, you nailed it. It's the perspective of someone who's done it. It adds credibility to when you're out in the community and you're trying to engage the community around utilizing the resources. If I go into a gym, even though they may know me, as the guy who manages their schedule. They don't know me as a Hall of Famer.
Right.
So one, it's the credibility, and two, it's you're right. It's as you just said, it's the perspective. So, we can check, there's a checks and balances there. Well, I think this could work. Well, actually, I feel like this can work based off this experience, et cetera. It was literally the two of us before we hired a team. And now our team across both facilities is over 40 people. But it was the two of us back in a cube, at our old headquarters, when people used to walk by us at a desk with like floor plans. And what are you guys doing? Oh, we're building a gym. Like, okay, good luck with that.
Yeah.
It was like the two of us, we set out on this journey, and now, I work with him every single day. Our wives are friends, or, we hang out outside of work. And it's something I've never lost perspective on. I've told him many times too. I used to, again, as a fan, I would travel to fights and, oftentimes went to his fights. So to be able to come in, you know, to the office every day and work alongside him, yeah, it's a really cool experience. Absolutely. And again, it's like, you want to connect to the athlete community and population. You'd be well served to have one of them on your side.
Yeah, for sure.
And we have the ultimate. I mean, the guy is such like a humble, you know, a humble guy. And you know, again, he reached the pinnacle. He was a champion. He's in the Hall of Fame for a reason.
Yeah.
So he's such a valuable asset to the team.
You kind of worked your way into this role, right? So you kind of started out in one area and kind of worked your way up, and you kind of kept changing and learning as you went through it. As you kind of look back and where you are now, what have you kind of determined and figured out? Like, if somebody wants to work in operations, somebody's listening right now and they're like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. Like the logistics and the structuring and the building out, this is the thing for me. What have you kind of learned or some of the most important skills or attributes somebody needs to be successful in this side?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, gosh, I always say this, but it's just the fact of the matter. I was, you know, in the right place at the right time, but I was prepared to take on this opportunity. I mean, I was literally given a ball to go run with, and it's turned into this. But you know, if I had to focus on, you know, one in particular skill set, but then expounding upon it, I mean, really, I think it comes down to soft skills, people skills. You know, you can be technically great and technically, you know, really, you know, sound in whatever kind of your niche is, you know, whether it's kind of, you know, financial or logistics or, you know, supply management, et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't know how to interact with people and relate to people and support people and lead people, you're not going to progress in your career. You know, I've always kind of valued myself as being, you know, somebody who can do all those things. And, you know, I think that, you know, my kind of trajectory within the UFC and, you know, the point I'm in now kind of supports that. I mean, I manage, you know, a team of, again, you know, alongside a couple other, you know, VPs for, you know, one of them, over 40 people globally. And, you know, for the most part, they're all my senior. But it's something that I really value in terms of just connecting to people and being seen as a leader in a sense of, you know, providing an environment in which it just facilitates their ability to do their job. You know, yeah, you need to be detail driven for sure in operations. You know, you need to have the ability to come into the office each day, each week, especially here, and have the ability to adapt, right? Because you're faced with a lot of fires that you need to put out, but you need to be even keeled in the way you go about that business. So I think, you know, it's a good temperament. You know, it's the soft skills that I mentioned, you know, your ability to communicate. And then really it's just having a broad skill set to where you're faced with different challenges and obstacles. You have the tool bag to reach into, to make it work and to find a solution. You need to be solution oriented. You know, I mean, if you're faced with problems, believe me, across any organization, this type of role, you're faced with problems. You need to find the most effective and efficient way to solve them. And, you know, hopefully you've built a groundswell within your team who is willing to go and solve those problems alongside you.
James, this has been incredible. I want to finish up with this. I look at your career and I see all you've accomplished and I see how you've grown within UFC and how excited you are about being there. You've made it. Like, you're in the industry, you're thriving. And now, even though you're there, you don't seem complacent. You're going back to get your MBA at Florida State. Yeah. Why? Like, not only how do you have time, but why? Like, what motivated this move? Why was this the important thing for you to do at this point?
Yeah, I have a 1.5-year-old at home too.
You are insane.
Talking about not having time. I mean, look, I've just always been that guy who's just not content, really. I'm very ambitious, and look, yeah, I'm living a dream job. I'm working a dream job. I love it, but as you said too, I've kind of grown into this role. I've had to learn on the job along the way. And for me, again, going back to the skill set, just, you know, in terms of, you know, like a head of operations, having a broad skill set, to tap into, I want to set myself up for continued growth moving forward, but, you know, two, and more importantly right now, to be more effective in my current role. And I think just rounding out my education again, I mean, gosh, I just finished, you know, courses in macroeconomics and global supply chain management, real estate investment, you know, which ties into, you know, working through lease terms with, you know, performance institutes around the world. So, you know, these skills that I'm learning in my MBA, I'm applying literally the same week, which is, you know, I'm dealing with macroeconomics, you know, I'm focusing a lot on, you know, the tariffs we have with China. Well, by the way, while I'm studying that, I'm importing millions of dollars of worth of goods into Shanghai, China.
Yeah, that's
so
crazy.
I mean, as I'm studying that, I'm applying it. And again, in Mexico City, we're dealing with sublandlords and landlords and understanding lease terms. So it is just broadening the skill set, but it's also just being able to do my work more and more effectively now.
James, this is incredibly impressive. I'm envious of all you've accomplished, and all that you're doing, continuing to push forward is so cool. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Brian, so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks to James for coming on the show. There's a ton to take away from that conversation, but one thing that sticks out to me is his desire to constantly improve. Did you hear the excitement in his voice as he talked about learning things in his MBA courses that he was instantly able to apply to his job? That's amazing. That's really cool. I find in life that I am naturally drawn to passionate people. I like music where it feels like the songs are pouring out of someone like an uncontrollable wave of emotion. I like to surround myself with people who take their craft seriously and have a passion for it. I have a friend of mine who's a plumber, and to hear him talk about what he does, he's not a guy that just goes through the motions. To him, it is art, and he is Picasso. I love that. I'm drawn to that. The same was very evident in James. Couldn't you hear the pride and excitement bubbling in his voice as he discussed the research and planning that went into creating the UFCPI? So cool. I'm feeling pretty pumped. Thanks, James. I'm really happy you came on. Time to hop in my altitude chamber and get in a good workout. Thanks for listening, everybody. Time to get back to work.